now, here's Jack Patty.
Good morning and welcome into Friday. It's the 18th of July. I'm Jack Patty. We're brought to you by Landscaper's Corner at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Landscaper's Corner has the largest selection of natural stone in our area. Call them at 225-9433. First of all, our question of the day is brought to you by United Structural Systems, a professional foundation repair company in business for 20 years. iFixFoundations.com, 859-254-7700. Here's the question. Do you believe that if Lexington police can take their cruisers home and for personal use, will it deter crime? Once again, do you believe that if Lexington police can take their cruisers home for personal use, will it deter crime? You tell us at WVLKAM.com. Tune in for the results with Cruiser and Crew between noon and 3. Yesterday, our question was, the jailer in Boyle County says its facility is full. Should we rethink how many people we put behind bars? That was a draw, 50-50. 50% said yes, 50% said no. Well, this is a Forensic Friday. Normally, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us, but he is on assignment. He has the day off, is what he has. And in his stead, we have Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Dan Laird. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Jack. Happy to be here again.
I'm doing well. Get right up on that mic. For some reason, if you're not right on it, we don't pick you up.
Well, I'll do my best.
You have become Ray's permanent stand-in. You know that, don't you?
Well, I have a face for radio.
Well, and you also have a lot more hair than he has. But then again, who doesn't?
No comment.
Yeah. We got an interesting subject this morning and some good guests with us. Please set us up.
Well, Jack, way back in the day, I moved here from Detroit to go to law school at the University of Kentucky, and I eventually stayed here. I've been here for about 20 years now, and, you know, people are talking about this recent rash of crime here in Lexington and comparing it to Detroit or Chicago or other cities. And that makes me a little nervous, and it makes me a little unhappy, and I wanted to bring a case to the show this morning that illustrates some of the problems we have here in Lexington getting not only illegal weapons off the street, but people who illegally own or possess these weapons, and our police officers deal with them a lot. So I have a case. This gentleman's name is Corinthian Gay, and I brought along one of several prosecutors who dealt with him as he spent some time with us in court, and that's Assistant Commonwealth Attorney David Startzman.
Hey, David.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I have Detective Don Dunn here from the Lexington Police Department, who was one of several police officers who dealt with Mr. Gay while he was in circuit court.
Good morning, Don.
Good morning.
You've been here before. You're a vet.
Yes,
you're a veteran of this show. Good. That sounds interesting. All right. Lead us off there.
All right. Well, Mr. Gay is 29 years of age as we speak here today, and he first came to our attention, by which I mean the Lexington Police Department's attention, in November of 2012. And that was a case, it was a patrol traffic stop that led to the discovery of a firearm and some other things of that nature. And I'll ask David to summarize that case, and we'll start to talk about how Mr. Gay was treated when he became involved in the court system.
So as Dan said, it was a traffic stop, and he was actually the passenger in the car. And the officers were, you know, conducting the traffic stop. I think it was for a failure to use left turn signal. So they started to search the car, and prior to their search, they asked the occupants of the car, including Mr. Gay, if there was anything in the car that they may find. Mr. Gay motioned for one of the officers to come over, and he said, "There's a gun under my seat." And so, sure enough, the officer looks under and finds the gun under his seat. Well, Mr. Gay has a prior felony conviction out of Madison County for theft by unlawful taking.
And that precludes one from having a gun in their possession, right?
Correct. And so he was charged with being a convicted felon in possession of a handgun at that charge.
Yeah. Did he claim that it wasn't his, or did he have any?
At trial, he claimed it wasn't
his. Yeah, okay.
And initially, at the traffic stop, he said it was his. Okay. And then he also had an outstanding warrant on him for a receiving stolen property charge, where he had pawned some stolen items from a guy that was helping him out, more or less. And it was just tools and vacuum cleaners and other things like that. So
the thing that impresses me as odd about that whole story is that the police pulled anybody over for failure to use a traffic signal, because we don't use them in this town.
I'd argue if I could, but I drive on New Circle Road almost every day.
Okay. Okay, so take it from there.
So so he gets charged with the two counts, and it was a felony. The receiving stolen property was also a felony amount, because it was over $500 reportedly by the victim. So he was charged with the convicted felon in possession of a handgun, and the receiving stolen property felony and being a persistent felony offender in the second degree on the receiving stolen property charge for his prior from Madison County. So we presented the case to the grand jury, and they indicted, and we began the process with that case. And so during his first status hearing, he was released on bond and put on electronic monitoring, which kind of leads us into the next case.
Okay.
Now, one thing that I'd like to explain maybe in a little more detail is that the bond decision is something that happens every day that we're in court. The general rules are that when you want the court to do something, you're supposed to do a written motion and give the other attorney a copy and send it ahead of time. Practically, what happens every day that we're in court when there's somebody incarcerated, the defense attorney will ask for the judge to review the bond. And I know that Ray has talked in some detail about House Bill 463 and the judge's decisions to keep the jail population down. So this case is typical of numerous other cases, in spite of the fact that there was a firearm involved and a prior felony and some other criminal history on this defendant. He was released. I believe the terms of the bond were that he was third-party released to his parents. So his mom or his dad, I guess, signed him out of jail, and they put a bracelet on his ankle. And so off he went. That was on December the 5th.
Okay, let me ask a couple of technical questions. This one's very basic, but I don't know the answer. What's the difference between bond and bail?
Well, as I understand it, it's fairly interchangeable.
Really?
In other states, I know in Michigan, they have bail bondsmen, people that will make money to bail people out of jail.
Right. We don't have that here, but we used to, years ago. When I was a kid, we had bail bondsmen.
Right. The legislature made that illegal, and so I guess technically the bond is the amount of money or the conditions upon which you're released. The bail is the money that you actually send. So I bring my bail over to post your bond. We basically use them interchangeably.
And so he was released to his parents or to his mother.
Right.
Now, and is there money that changes hands there? That
I don't think so.
No.
I think maybe there's a filing fee.
Okay.
We don't really get involved in that. We just the surety. The theory is that the surety, the person that signs them out, is responsible for them to come back to court and can be held accountable if they don't follow the conditions of their bond.
But in a situation where we hear the bond was set at $10,000 or whatever, the party who that bond is set against has to come up with, is it 10%?
It depends. Typically, the bond is set. We have a schedule where the bond for something is $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is.
Okay.
The judges in district court and then again in circuit court will typically, if the criminal history isn't too bad, make it a 10% bond. So your bond is $10,000, 10% means you post a grand and you walk out.
Then you're out.
The door.
I see.
Right.
Okay. And if you don't show up, that money, first of all, is forfeited, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And we do that a lot, ask for bond forfeiture. I don't really know what happens to it after that. We just try to get the judge to enforce the bond because it's not an uncommon thing for people to get out on bond and disappear or commit new crimes.
I don't think we have ever talked about that on the show before, and I never did understand that. That's interesting.
And if the defendant doesn't show up, not only is the bond can be revoked, but the judge can issue a warrant for his arrest because he's failure to appear.
Failure to appear, and that's another charge that then will go.
It can be.
On
it can be contempt, or it can be a bail jump. We're pretty serious about getting people to come to court.
Contempt of court or a bail jumping charge.
Right.
Really, that's interesting. I know there's a lot more to this story, but why don't we do this? Let's go ahead and take this opportunity to take a break, and we will be right back. If you have a question or comment, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1.com. Our guest this morning, from the prosecutor's office, Assistant Commonwealth Attorneys Dan Laren and David Starchman, and Detective Don Dunn from the police department. If you just tuned in, we're talking about getting people off the street who illegally possess guns. We've talked about trying to get guns off the street before, but this is a little different subject. Dan?
Well, in this particular case, the weapon that was recovered by the police was put into property and evidence, and as far as I know, it's still there. They've destroyed it, or however they, the police department disposes of these weapons. Mr. Gay was released from custody on his parents' signature and with an ankle monitor. One of the conditions of bond is not to commit any further crimes, and that didn't really last too long in this case. So I'll ask Detective Dunn to talk about how Mr. Gay came to the attention of the Lexington Police Department once again.
Okay, I got involved back December 20th, 2012. We had officers that were dispatched out to basically a home invasion and met with a victim who had been the victim of the home invasion. I get involved as the robbery homicide detective, come out and meet with the victim during my investigation with him. He says that he's at his house, had just gotten out of the shower, hears a knock at the door. When he goes to the door, is met with a subject, male black subject, and gives a description of him, who's armed with a handgun and forces his way into the house. The suspect's there for approximately an hour in the house with him, ransacking the house, trying to find, you know, whatever he wants to take from the victim. When I'm talking to the victim, he actually states that he's seen the suspect before. The suspect's actually come to his house to pick up one of their, I guess, mutual friends or one of the victim's friends, and gives me a name of Corey.
Let me say something here. We talked about this before, too. Home invasions are almost, I'll make a statement, you tell me if it's true or not. It seems to me that home invasions almost always, they know the people in the home they're going into, and there's a reason for that. And the reason I say that is I think normal people are scared to death of a home invasion, but the reality is if you're not dealing drugs and don't hang with, you know, the wrong crowd, chances are you won't be invaded. Is that accurate?
I would say that's pretty accurate. I mean, okay. You know, most of the time they know the victim.
Yeah, okay. So in this case, he did.
Correct.
Okay.
So we start digging into trying to find out who the suspect is. He's given me the physical description of the suspect. He's given me, you know, he knows the suspect as Corey. So I start doing some digging and find a subject who matches the physical description. One of the things that kind of stuck out about the suspect, he's very tall, about 6'3", 6'4", and he's a male black with very long hair, long enough to pull it back in a ponytail. So in one of my databases, I find a subject by the name of Corinthian Gay, matches that description. So at that point, what we do is we compile a sequential photographic lineup. So we take six people, put them in a lineup. They all, you know, have similar features, similar age range, weight, and all that jazz. Put them in a lineup. The victim will look at all six pictures and identify or not. If they see the suspect,
you never do that like in the old days or in the movies where you actually line people up. They're all done with photographs.
Yes,
now,
it's
right?
All photographs.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
All right.
So I sit down with the victim, show him all six pictures. He is able to positively identify at that point Corinthian Gay as Corey, who had come into the house armed with a gun and robbed him. After I had this conversation with the victim and he's been positively identified, I find out that the suspect is on an ankle monitor. So at that point, I'm able to call down, since he's had a history before, I'm able to call down to the jail and they can print out exactly where he's been at. So they can print out that he's been, I think, what did we say earlier, 18 feet is the range.
Wow.
So he's been at the victim's house and tracking around the victim's house, you know, during this time frame, which is accurate, over an hour.
So the lesson to be learned here is if you're going to commit a crime, don't do it with an ankle bracelet on, right?
You would think, you know, an armed robbery, that's a Class B felony. That's
right.
We're serious about that. We're serious about all of it.
Right.
I think it's a much lower level offense to cut your ankle bracelet off. And if you're going to stick a gun in somebody's face, you might as well take the tether off.
Okay, so what's the next step after that? He's got an ankle bracelet. You kind of know who he is. You can figure out where he is.
Yeah.
Get him?
At that point, Detective Bowles, who works with our unit, and I go out and we meet with Corinthian Gay, and I have the printout of his ankle monitor. So we sit down, Mirandize him, give him his rights, and start talking about this robbery, and I slide across the piece of paper that's got his ankle monitor. You know, it dots, I think, every minute, I think, is what it dots. And so it shows him, so I start asking about it. You know, obviously we know he's there, tell him that, and he admits to being there. He admits to going in and having been over there before. Of course, he doesn't have a gun, though. You know, he was the lookout in this. He wasn't the, you know, the main instigator, I guess, if you will. So
did he implicate somebody else as being that?
There was a second suspect, yes. So, but he minimized his involvement, but did, I mean, obviously he had to admit he's there. We had the proof that. So, so at that point, we charged him with the robbery first.
All right. And so now we have the condition of, or the issue where he's on bond, he's been arrested and charged with another offense, not to mention a robbery and persistent felony offender charge. And after the news break here, we'll talk about how the case progressed through the system. I believe these cases were both tried before juries.
All right, taking a break. 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll VLK, an interesting program this morning. Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Dan Lahren is with us, and also Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney David Startzman. We have Don Dunn from the Police Department, detective with the Lexington Police Department. Dan? Well, and this Glenn Beck lookalike, I might add, to Dan. Yes,
always,
yes, sir.
Always a face for radio.
Yes.
So Mr. Gay goes back into the detention center in January, and he was arraigned on his other case, and his cases began to move through circuit court. The case went to trial in February, I believe, after a couple of delays, and I'll ask David to explain the issues that were presented to the jury and what happened in that case.
So we presented the first case that he got first, which was the one that he was out on bond when he was a GPS monitoring when he committed the armed robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because it was convicted felon in possession of a handgun, one of the things that we have to prove is that he had a prior conviction, prior felony conviction.
That's PFO. But PFO is the charge?
PFO is an enhancement charge for other felony charges.
Gotcha.
But for a convicted felon charge, you need to be with possession of a handgun. As you said earlier, you can't possess a handgun or a firearm if you're a convicted felon.
Right.
So one of the things that we need to prove in our case in chief is that the guy was a convicted felon.
Gotcha.
So that would be prejudicial to his receiving stolen property charge. So we had to, the defense made a motion, and we didn't object to it, to sever the charges. So we tried the convicted felon in possession of a handgun charge first, and then severed the receiving stolen property charge for a later date. So that,
is that common?
We have to do that.
Okay.
You know, basically, it's if the jury understands that the defendant is a felon, they'll be more likely to convict him on his other charges. Who wouldn't?
Yeah, sure.
That's the first question anybody ever asks us is, what'd the guy do?
Yeah.
Well, what's his record? What'd he do before? Has he done it before? Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And so he gets to go in front of the jury with a clean slate, and that's what happened in this case.
Mm-hmm. So we went to trial on the convicted felon in possession of a handgun charge in February, I think it was February 6th of this year. And jury came back and found him guilty of that charge and gave him recommended a sentence of 5 years, which he was later.
Now, in that case, did it basically become a swearing contest between the defendant and the patrol officer as far as the statements he made?
Yeah, I mean, he, as I said earlier, the defendant in this case started saying, no, I didn't. It wasn't my gun. It was another person's gun. It wasn't mine. You know, I was just in the car. But the officer got him saying and said, but you told me it was my gun, and I found it where you told me I was going to find it. So
mm-hmm.
it did become a little bit of a he said type situation. So
the jury convicted Mr. Gay on the felon in possession charge.
Correct.
And they recommended a sentence. I believe it was 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was the sentencing in that case, was it independent of the robbery case? Was it set to be resolved?
Yeah, it was set independently of the robbery case. But by law, because he was out on bond for this charge, the robbery case, whatever he got at that trial, would have to run consecutive to the first case.
So
and he actually ended up pleading guilty to the misdemeanor, or to a receiving stolen property charge.
So that was the related charge on this case. Was he sentenced before the robbery case, or did that sentencing continued after?
The defense made a motion and was granted to continue the sentencing. Because one of the things.
What does that mean?
To push it off, basically. And I forget the reasons why, but basically what they were doing strategically, which was to, by putting off the sentencing, we couldn't use the prior conviction that he just got by the jury in February against him in the second trial.
And that'll become important when we talk about the sentencing in his second case.
Okay.
But that is an example of a tactic, I guess, is the nice way to say it. I think of it as a trick or a device to make sure that the second jury didn't know that he'd been convicted for carrying a gun before.
Right.
And that becomes important when we'll talk in
it. And that's a decision that the judge makes.
Right. That the judge had discretion in it to do that.
And so he allowed that.
That's how it works in the Fiat Circuit Court.
Okay. All right.
So we have him convicted of possession of a handgun by a felon, a 5-year sentence recommended, and then the robbery case he got arraigned on the robbery case in April of 2013, pled out the receiving, and then I guess you can explain how the negotiations went for the robbery or how it eventually wound up going to trial.
So robbery first is a violent offense, and it's also under statute, receives violent time for that offense.
What's that mean, violent
They've
time?
They've got to serve, the person that if they're convicted has to serve 85% of that, whatever the amount of years is. So
otherwise, it's 20, is that right?
Yeah.
If it's a nonviolent, okay. Mm-hmm. So that's a big deal.
That's a very bright line in all of our cases that are charged as violent offenses.
And so the defense attorney was making counteroffers of robbery second or some less, either equal amount or less time, but just to get down to that 20% range instead of being up in the 85% range and the violent time. So, we never were able to come to an agreement in terms of years and what kind of a plea deal would be. So we ended up going to trial actually this past July 7th, this month.
Just a few days ago.
Yeah. And
you want to hold it and tell us what happened after the break, or you want to keep going here? We can go a few more minutes, or
we can just kind of set up the issues at the trial.
Okay.
If you could just talk.
Going
about
back on the prejudice, the prejudicial stuff to the defendant, we talked a little bit before about severing the charges. The other things that we couldn't talk about at this time was we had to come up with a unique way to call what the ankle monitoring was, and couldn't talk about the Department of Corrections that runs the ankle monitoring. We had to call them a special name too. So,
wow, that's interesting. Well, because that would prejudice the jury.
Absolutely.
If you
prejudice
said
the defendant in the eyes of the jury.
Yeah. Gotcha. That's very interesting. All right, we're going to take a break. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. 947, 13 before 10, News Talk 590, WVLK. And Assistant Commonwealth's Attorneys Dan Laren and David Startzman in the studio with us, Detective Don Dunn from the Police Department. And take it, Dan.
All right. Well, now we're up to the trial of the robbery case, and this is an armed robbery case. It's a Class B felony, which is 10 to 20 years. It's a violent offense, and we're going to talk a little bit about the tactical decisions that had to be made before the trial based on the rules that protect defendants when they go to face a jury. So, David, if you would explain, we touched on a little bit on the GPS issues. What kind of things did you have to deal with in preparing the case for trial?
So we filed a motion or a notice, actually, of letting the court know and the defense attorney know that we intended to put on the evidence that the GPS monitoring device puts him at the place of the robbery at the time.
Now, that in itself presents a problem.
Right, because it shows that if the person is out on, in this case, the defendant was out on bond for another case, then it goes back to the whole propensity thing that Dan was talking about before, about how if you committed another crime before and you're out on bond on that crime, then you're more likely to have committed this crime.
Right, exactly. Prejudice
the defendant.
Yeah. So how do you work around that?
We, because we also wanted to file the notice to get some guidance from the court to figure out how, and we decided to call it a GPS monitoring device. And instead of the Department of Corrections, it was a Lexington Fayette Urban County government employee that was the person that was able to talk about in the GPS monitoring device and the program and how it worked and everything.
Was there the court agreed to that, or?
Yeah, that was the agreement that we came to with the defense.
With the defense attorneys, okay, all right. A layman, I think if I was sitting on the jury, I'd be thinking, why does this guy got a GPS device on?
I don't know anybody else that does it other than corrections.
Yeah.
I don't know if maybe foster care or some sort of family thing. But I'm not aware of anything other than people who should be in jail.
Yeah. But you just couldn't call it an ankle bracelet.
Right.
And I believe you had to coach your witness, and then he had to change his appearance for the trial, right?
Yeah, we actually, because he's a corrections officer, and so he normally wears
a uniform,
an officer uniform, and so he had to come and testify in a suit and tie instead. Okay.
And you had to coach him as to what he could and couldn't say.
Right, so he couldn't go into his training experience because a lot of it involves his training as a corrections officer. And so he could only talk about his training with the GPS system that they use and then how long he's used that particular system.
That's the interesting thing about this program is we have learned over the years so many of the technicalities that the general public doesn't know. And this is another one of them. And I understand the law. I'm sure you do too, Dan, as far as the protection of the, the defendant. But at the same time, it's interesting how much kind of dancing around you have to do.
You know, everybody should have a fair day in court. I mean, Mr. Gay, like anybody else charged with a crime, should have the opportunity to be treated fairly, to come in and explain or justify his behavior, or at least make sure that we prove our case. And one of my friends that works with Don once told me that, I walk into that courtroom and I take the oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And when I have enough time and that I can retire, I'm going to tell the judge, yeah, I will if you let me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of funny, but kind of cynical. And it's
sad,
absolutely
really.
True.
Yeah.
Well, Don, you testified in this trial as well.
I did.
Did you have to be careful about telling the jury what you know about
the case? Sure, because, our job, is to gather all of the proof that we can and give it to Dan and Dave. And, again, like he said, get up there and tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But then we have to dance around, how we say certain things and, ankle monitor versus the GPS monitoring.
Hypothetically, what if that slipped?
That would be a mistrial, probably.
Really? And then you'd start all over again?
Basically.
So you don't want
that
to happen?
No.
Yeah, right.
No, I mean, it costs the county a lot of money to pay for the jurors. We're taking up court time. We're taking police officers off the street.
Right.
The victim had to come in. If I recall, he had a job or he was a student, so he had to take his day off.
Right.
So we really try to resolve these cases one way or the other. So this case, we're talking
obviously about, the testimony of Don is really critical to the case, too.
I think the jurors, my experience has shown that jurors will listen to patrol officers, but they put a lot more weight on what detectives tell them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the perception is, if a patrol officer makes a stop and it's a burglary case, well, that's one thing. But if it's an important enough case that the detectives get involved, and to be fair, the detectives tend to be more experienced police officers,
right,
and they testify a lot more often. Most of our better witnesses from the police department are the robbery homicide detectives.
Yeah, and they've got a lot of experience testifying.
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
Okay.
So in this case, we're in the guilt phase. If you would explain how the case unfolded, what the defense, if any, was, and how the case proceeded until sentencing.
The defense, as Don kind of touched on earlier about the defendant's statement that he made to the detectives. So their defense kind of followed off of that and was just, I'm a lookout. I wasn't there to rob this guy. I was just there to help with the robbery, basically.
Okay.
That was kind of the defense. So.
And did the defendant actually take the stand and testify?
He did take the stand and testify.
And how would you describe his demeanor? What do you think he was trying to show the jury?
Well, I think he was trying to show that he was just a lookout, but the way that it came across was a little more. He talked about helping to plan the planning the robbery and walking around and figuring out how to get in the house and just a lot more than what you would consider a lookout to be doing. He was a lot more involved and a lot more thought behind the robbery than just a lookout.
And when you cross-examine him, you get to ask him if he has a felony conviction. Is that
yes,
correct?
That's
but you
correct.
Don't get to go into anything else about his background, his history, or the fact that he was on bond for another weapons-related charge.
That comes in the sentencing phase. You can do that, but not until then. Okay.
Yeah, because that would be prejudicial in the
guilt
phase. So.
How long did the trial last?
It lasted 2 days. So we presented our proof on Wednesday of July 7th, and then they put on their proof on Wednesday as well, and then we did closings in this sentencing part of the trial.
What kind of defense did they put on?
He testified, and that was it. And so he just kind of followed up with what his statement was to the detectives.
And then you had an opportunity also to cross-examine him?
Yes, and actually Aspen Carlisle was the assistant
Commonwealth
attorney that was lead on the case. So she had the she took the cross-examination. Okay. And, so.
And then how long was the jury out?
The jury was out on Thursday for about 2 hours, I want to say, in the guilt phase.
Okay.
Which is pretty standard, I think, for that kind of that serious nature of the crime.
And I've also learned through this show you can never predict and you can't guess based on time.
Absolutely.
Anything. Don't, is there anything involved in this case that is unique that we have not talked about from your standpoint?
I know that, you know, we're talking about what David was talking about, going in and interviewing the witness and kind of him interviewing the suspect, I'm sorry, and him kind of minimalizing his role in this. You know, again, like to just piggyback off what David said, obviously we knew he was there. We could prove that. He advises that he's the lookout, but one of the things that he said and that we could cooperate with the witness or the victim in this case is that he's the lookout, but he's the first one knocking on the door, the first one in, armed with a handgun. So that was another thing to kind of help us, mm-hmm. you know, to show how much he was really involved and not just, hey, I'm standing on the porch making sure nobody comes up the street.
Sure.
So
what happened after the jury came back? What did they give him?
They found him guilty of robbery in the first degree. So
okay.
It's the charge that he was indicted on and the charge that he received from the police. So they came back and found him guilty.
And what happened in the sentencing phase?
He was also charged with being a persistent felony offender in the second degree, which we've talked before on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And
That
adds time. So that takes it up to 20 years, 20 to 50 years.
With an 85%?
Correct.
Yeah.
And so we put on the proof for about the prior felony from Madison County, but the jury came back and did not find him guilty of the PFO second. So he was just guilty of the robbery first.
We call that nullification, where the jurors either think it's too much time or they just choose not to believe the evidence, you know, because it's abundantly clear that he was a persistent felony offender. Now, and the important thing here, and we touched on this before, is that the jury did not get to know that he was on bond and had been convicted
right.
for a weapons-related charge. And I had talked to Aspen, and I agree that I think the jury would have made a different decision if
they'd been able to know that.
But the defense attorney was successful in evading his client's responsibility for that until after the jury's decision.
Thank you, guys. Stand by. We have an update from ABC. If you're listening to WVLK AM, stay with us. We have Live with Lee. If you're listening to 101.5 FM, the Coach's Show with Joe B. and Denny, have a great weekend. I'll be back Monday morning at 6:05 Central.